within me, Lord. I bless your holy name. I live my life to worship you alone. You brought me out of darkness and into your glorious light.
Blessed are you, Yahweh, our Elohim, and Elohim of our forefathers, Elohim of Avraham, Elohim of Yitzhak, and Elohim of Yaakov, the great, mighty, and awesome Elohim, El Elyon, who bestows beneficial kindnesses and creates everything, who recalls the kindness of the patriarchs and brings a redeemer to their children's children for his name's sake with love. O King, Helper, Savior, and Shield, blessed are you, Yahweh, Shield of Avraham. Shalom. Welcome to my first teaching for the Wisdom and Torah blog site. I'd like to start off by thanking Rico for allowing me the opportunity to share with you all the wonderful things that Yahweh has hidden in his Torah. Today we're going to be talking about the Book of Ruth and how it connects with Shavuot. Have you ever wondered why leavened bread was offered on Shavuot, but no leaven was allowed in any sacrifice on any other day of the year? Have you ever wondered why the Book of Ruth is read on Shavuot? Or how about this? Have you ever wondered why Moshe had to remove his sandals when he came into the presence of the Creator of heaven and earth? Today we're going to be answering those questions and more in this teaching called Shadows of the Kingdom, Shavuot, and the Book of Ruth. This is part one to the teaching, where we'll be going over some background information that will help us understand some of the concepts that will be discussed later on. Part two, we will be midrashing the Book of Ruth chapter by chapter to see some of the hidden things in there that Yahweh has left for us. And in part three, we will be wrapping it all up. We will be connecting the Book of Ruth, Shavuot, the Messiah, and the restoration of the kingdom. All right, so getting started. The names of Shavuot. First off, Shavuot is from the word Shavua, which means week, and the Ot part is simply pluralization in the Hebrew. So Shavuot means week, so Feast of Weeks. It's also known as Pentecost. Pentecost is a Greek word, which means 50 count. This makes sense to call it that because we come to Shavuot by counting to 50. From the time that the barley harvest was brought in. It's also called the Festival of the Harvest, the Day of First Fruits, not to be confused with the Feast of First Fruits, which occurs during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And within Judaism, it is also known as Chag Matan Torah, or the Festival of Giving of the Torah. And I'm sure there are plenty of other names, but those are the ones that I chose to share with everyone today. All right, so Shavuot, the Festival of First Fruits. In order to actually celebrate this feast, you must celebrate Pesach and the Feast of Unleavened Bread first. This establishes the timing for the count of 50 days, which brings us to Shavuot. And during the Feast of First Fruits, during Unleavened Bread, people would bring the first fruits of their barley harvest. During Shavuot, this would be the first fruits of the wheat harvest, as well as the first fruits of other harvests that happened around this time. And what people would do is when they would, their first budding of the fruit on whatever plant, they would go out to their vineyard and they would tie a reed cord around that fruit, setting it apart. And then come Shavuot time, all those would be collected in, and they would make a pilgrimage festival to Jerusalem in order to offer up their first fruits before the King of the Universe, Yahweh Tsevaot. What they would do is when they were approaching Jerusalem, they would take their first fruits and put them in a basket on their head and carry them into the city. There was also a tradition of their animals that were going to be offered, their horns would be dipped in gold, or plated, sorry, in gold, or silver, depending on how early or how late they came to the festival. As I discussed earlier, there was the counting of the Omer. You were commanded to count the 50 days between the festival of first fruits and the time when Shavuot would occur. And this is important. Regardless of how you come to determine when Shavuot is, the Bible specifically commands that there's a counting of days. And that's why I believe there's no specific date given, is because the intention is to understand that there's a counting going on. And this counting is tied in with another counting of 50. If you all remember, the Jubilee year happens every 50 years. The Yovel, or Jubilee, is a year when all the land is released and returned to the original owners, and all servants are released, male, female, and the children. So unlike the seventh year, or the Shemitah year, when just the servants were released and their wife and children were not released, this time everything is released. And there's also a commandment that all land is not to be sold beyond reclaim. All right. This was also one of the three pilgrimage festivals. When you study an ancient Near Eastern covenant treaty, you will realize that there was a tribute required for the suzerain, or the great king. And Shavuot is that one of those three feasts where we are required, when in the land, to come up before the king and offer a tribute. There were two loaves baked. There was a mincha offering done that was a flour offering without leaven, but then there were also two leavened bread loaves that were baked and waved as a wave offering. They were not burnt on the fire, but they were offered, and it specifically called for leaven. And this has been a mystery to many people throughout the ages. They could not understand why leaven would be offered. And you know what? In this series, we are going to uncover the real reason behind that. In addition to these bloodless offerings, 26 animals were offered, which is interesting because the gematria of the name Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, is 26. And then lastly, with this feast, Judaism teaches that there's a second day, which is called Yom Tov, which is to be observed outside the land of Israel. If you want more information on Shavuot, a great resource is the Temple Institute. And you can see the URL right below on the screen. All right. The traditional parashah or Torah readings for Shavuot are Exodus 19, verse 1 through 20, verse 23, Numbers 28, 26 through 31, and then on Yom Tov, or the second day, they would either read Deuteronomy 14, verses 22 through 16, verse 17, or Deuteronomy 15, verse 19 through 16, verse 17, depending on if it was a Shabbat or a weekday. For the Haftorah readings, they would read Ezekiel 1:1 through 28 and 3 verse 12, and Habakkuk 2 verse 20, and I'm going to have to change that. I've got the wrong thing on my slide. And then they would also read Megillat Ruth. All right. Now, Shavuot has occurred multiple times in history. As you well know, feasts of Yahweh don't have just one single occurrence. They're cyclical. And just as things have happened in the past, we expect these same feasts to be prophetic for the future, for us today. What Judaism has come up with is kind of a list. I took some of them and I didn't put all of them into this teaching, but they believe that the death of Abel occurred on Shavuot. The Tower of Babel, the mixing of the languages, occurred on Shavuot. Mount Sinai, the giving of the Torah, is believed to have occurred on Shavuot. The tribe of Benjamin was restored. You can read that in Judges 21, verses 15 through 24. The story of Ruth occurred around the time of Shavuot. The birth and death of King David occurred on Shavuot. And of course, we know that Acts 2 occurred on Shavuot. Going through the list, Abel kind of makes sense because these were two twins at war. It's believed that Abel and Cain were both twins. And Shavuot always falls on the third month, which is under the astrological sign of Gemini. And Gemini is a constellation sign, or I'm sorry, a Maserat sign, that is two twins in unity. So Cain and Abel are kind of the opposite of that. And also Babel is a kind of a disunity. It's where the languages were mixed. People were scattered apart. At Mount Sinai, the Torah was given. And this was thought to be a restoration, or sorry, this was a restoration of the earthly theocratic kingdom that had not existed on the earth since the fall of Adam. When in Exodus 20 verses, let's look this up real fast. Exodus 20 verse 18, it says, "And the people saw the thunders, the lightning flashes, the sound of the ram's horn, the mountain smoking, and the people saw it and they trembled and stood at a distance." The word for thunderings is plural. And according to Jewish commentary, and also in Philo, De Decalogo, this pluralization actually is referring to not thunderings, but tongues of fire. It was believed that when Yahweh spoke, his voice split up into all tongues of fire, and they came upon the entire camp. And also that his voice split into 70 languages. And Judaism believes this occurs, or that his voice went out to the entire earth. My belief, based off of my understanding of covenant, ancient Near Eastern covenants, is that he was making a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai, and so his voice would have only gone out to them. But within the camp of Israel, we know there was a mixed multitude. There was people who represented every nation of the earth, who probably spoke every nation of the earth at that time, which there were 70 languages at the time. And you know what? It wasn't just Israel that was there. Or sorry, when, let me take that back. Let's go to Acts 7, verse 38. It was Israel, but Israel was called by a different name there in Acts 7, verse 38. And we read here, let me switch over to the King James Version, because this is the most commonly accepted by Christianity. "This is he that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel which spake to him at Mount Sinai with our fathers who received the lively oracles to give unto us." So while it was Israel, Israel clearly is called the church in Acts 7 verse 38. And these lively oracles, when you look up the word oracles, it's the word davar. And davar in ancient Near Eastern treaties was the language used with the covenant or the treaty that was given by the great king to his vassals. So whenever you hear that unto the Jews the oracles were given, that means the covenant was given to the Jews, which of course in the first century also took on the connotation of not just Judah, but all of Israel at some points in time in the first century writings. All right, also occurring at Mount Sinai, we had the incident of the golden calf. And 3,000 men died there. And then we fast forward to Acts 2, and 3,000 are joined to the congregation of Yahweh, the true remnant. And also during that time, there was a splitting up of Yahweh's word into tongues of fire, and the Spirit came down in tongues of fire, and they received the gift of tongues. Now, some people believe this is babbling, but if you look at the text, this isn't just incoherent babbling. They were actually speaking languages that they were not born with the ability to speak, or they never knew how to speak that language before, and suddenly they were able to speak in a language that they did not know in order to tell other people. So if you have the gift of tongues, what we're talking about here, in accordance with Acts chapter 2, I'm not going to talk about the other verses, because there are other verses that could be taken as this language of angels, but we'll not deal with that. But according to Acts chapter 2, if you had that gift, you would be able to talk to someone who is from a different nationality who did not speak English, and they would be able to understand you. All right. Now, I mentioned that the Feast of Shavuot falls under Gemini. Gemini, as you can see here, is a picture of twins who are in unity. And this is according to rabbinical sources that they believe that the twins in unity is the sign of Gemini. And according to them, it was disunity that separated the two kingdoms of Israel. And beyond that, it was disunity which destroyed the first temple and also led the second temple to become ruined. All right. Now, this is some important understanding to understand the background of Ruth. Who was Ruth? Ruth, multiple times, is called a Moabite. A Moabite was a descendant of Lot. And so we're going to have to go back and look over who was Lot and what importance was he to the covenant. Now, in Genesis 12, Yahweh told Abraham to get up and go to a land. And let's just go there and read that little account first. And Yahweh said to Abram, "Go yourself out of your land, from your relatives, and from the house of your father's house, to a land which I show you, and I will make you a great nation, and bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and curse him who curses you. And in you all the clans of the earth will be blessed." So Abram was given a royal grant there. He was told if he goes and does this, he wasn't given a royal grant, he was given the promise of a royal grant. And if he were to follow what God told him to, which was just to get up and leave. And Lot joined himself to Abram at the time, and made a covenant with him, even though the text doesn't say that. We know that he was a very important part of Abram's life, because later on, Abram gets up and defends Lot when he's taken captive. So if Lot was in a covenant with Abram, that would mean that Lot was party to the covenant that Yahweh made with Abram. We also know from the text, it infers that Lot was actually going to be Abram's successor, in the case that Abram did not have any sons. So he was a very important person to Abram. Eventually, Lot and Abram split over disunity, strife between their herdsmen. And so they split the land up. And eventually, Lot goes and he settles in Sodom and gets captured by a king named Chedorlaomer. Now, Chedorlaomer means until the time of the Omer. Now, that sounds a whole lot like Shavuot language to me. So, when we look at this, Abram goes out, gets a band of 318 men, and they go and they free Lot, take all the spoils that were captured by Chedorlaomer and his group of nations, and Abram gives all the stuff back except for he gives a tithe to Melchizedek, which the word Melchizedek, the name Melchizedek, means king of righteousness. So it's very interesting that Chedorlaomer ruled until the time of the Omer, and then once he's defeated, Abram goes and brings up an offering of the best of the spoils of the war. So we see right there a kind of a picture of Shavuot going on. Now, later on, we have more proof that Lot was actually in covenant with Abram, and thus in covenant with Yahweh, because when Sodom and Gomorrah are about to be destroyed, Yahweh sends two messengers to rescue Lot from Sodom. So the messengers come there, and there's a crowd that tries to, they want to rape the messengers, and Lot throws his daughter, or tries to give his daughters to this angry mob. And that kind of comes back to bite him, because when he leaves Sodom and he goes up into the mountains and Sodom's destroyed, suddenly his daughters fornicate with him. And when you read the text, it's really kind of interesting. It says, Lot's daughter said, "Our father is old, and there is no man on the earth to come into us, as in is the way of all the earth. Let us make our father drunk with wine and lie with him, so that we preserve the seed of our father." They believed that all men had perished from the earth. They thought they were the only people left in the world. And so they wanted to preserve the seed of their father, which we'll talk about in a minute, about preserving the seed through a what's called a Levirate marriage. So the product of this fornication is Moab and Ben-Ami, who become the nations of Moab and Ammon. And then we go to when Israel comes out of Egypt, and they have an encounter with Moab and Ammon. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6. "An Ammonite or a Moabite does not enter the assembly of Yahweh. Even a tenth generation of them does not enter the assembly of Yahweh, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the way when you came out of Mitzrayim, and because they hired against you Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor of Aram Naharim, to curse you. But Yahweh your Elohim refused to listen to Balaam, and Yahweh your Elohim turned the curse into a blessing for you, because Yahweh your Elohim loves you. Do not seek their peace, nor their good, all your days, forever." Pretty harsh language there. Reading into the rabbinical commentary, they say that it was actually the men of Moab and Ammon that Yahweh was against, because it was the men, the role of a man to meet travelers and provide food and drink. Thus, they believe that only males are prohibited from entering the congregation. And this is in the Talmud, the Oral Torah. And we will cover that more in depth later on when we're going through the Book of Ruth. All right, so what I was talking about with Lot and his daughters, what's known as a levirate marriage, that's a French term, it's a Latin term, that means basically just a marriage of a brotherly marriage. So in Devarim 25, verses 5 through 10, "When brothers dwell together and one of them died and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not become a stranger outside. Her husband's brother does go into her and shall take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears does rise up for the name of his dead brother, so that his name is not blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, 'My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He does not agree to perform the duty of my husband's brother.' The elders of his city shall then call him and speak to him, and he shall stand and say, 'I have no desire to take her.' And then the brother's wife shall come up to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit on his face, and answer, and say, 'Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel his name shall be called the house of him who had his sandal removed.'" Now, this may seem like a very strange custom to us, and an equally strange response, the removing of the shoe and spitting in their face and then calling the man the house of him whose shoe was removed. But this was a very common practice in the ancient Near East. This was not exclusive to Israel. This was, when you look into the ancient Near Eastern documents, there was a variation of this practice, but it was well known. And then when we look at the example of like Judah and Tamar, and also with Ruth, this levirate marriage isn't just limited to the brother. It also goes on to extended family. If there's no brother, then a redeemer is to redeem them. And the whole intent here is to keep the family land within that family by producing a son who would take over and have that same, like what we would call today, a last name. That same name would be progenated by the offspring of a levirate marriage. This was done, or this was all done, like I just said, about the inheritance. And it's very symbolic of Yahweh giving us a second chance even after death. Because in the ancient Near Eastern mind, a son is just a continuation of life of the father. So the father dies without a son, and then this redeemer produces a son with the widowed wife, and then that is considered to be the same blood of that husband. The first example that we have of a levirate marriage actually occurs in Genesis 38. Judah marries a Canaanite woman whose name is Shua, meaning cry for help, and produces Onan, and Shelah. Marries Tamar, but does evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and Yahweh kills him for it. So Judah arranges a levirate marriage between Tamar and Onan. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his because he knew the laws of Yahweh that have been eternal from the very beginning, from Adam, that say when you do the levirate marriage, the firstborn does not belong to the one who, to the brother. It belongs to the deceased. So since he knew this, he spills his seed onto the ground, thus preventing giving it to his brother. So as a result, Onan dies. So now Judah's down two sons, and he's got one left that is obviously a little bit too young for marriage. So Judah sends Tamar back to her family and tells her that she'll stay there until Shelah is old enough to marry her. Judah's wife dies, and assumably enough time has passed that Shelah should have been old enough to marry Tamar, but he has not yet been offered, or she has not been offered to him. So Tamar removes her widow's clothes, and she hears that Judah's going to be coming down through the land, so she dresses like a harlot, covering her face. So Judah sleeps with Tamar unknowingly and promises Tamar a gift or a payment, and Tamar takes his seal, his cord, and his staff as a guarantee for that payment. Well, 3 months later, and remember, three is the number of the month of Shavuot, it's discovered that Tamar is pregnant. So Judah puts her on trial, and then at that trial, she reveals it's actually Judah who is the father. So Tamar gives birth to twins. Or 3 months later, Gemini, twins, kind of interesting connection, and Peretz and Zerach is born. Zerach comes out first and is marked with a cord. Another interesting connection. Remember that first fruits were marked with a cord. All right, so in addition to the redemption of the offspring, the Torah also provides for redemption of the land. Beyond, not speaking of the Jubilee year, but actually redemption by a family member. So we're going to turn to Vayikra 25, verses 23 through 28. And the land is not to be sold beyond reclaim, for the land is mine. for you are sojourners and settlers with me, and provide for a redemption for the land in all the land of your possession. When your brother becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and his redeemer, a close relative, comes to redeem it, then he shall redeem what his brother sold. And when the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale and return the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he shall return to his possession. And if his hand has not found enough to give back to him, then what is sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be released in the year of Jubilee, and he shall return to his possession. So if he becomes too poor, he can sell it. And also this applies to if someone dies, then that land would be sold and then later could be redeemed by a family member. All right, so I've been talking about redeemer. Let's look at the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is goel. The duty of a goel is to redeem property alienated from his family, redeem a member of the family who has fallen into slavery or servitude, and to redeem blood that is taken away from the family by a murderer. And I have a quote here. Henry Clay Trumbull, who wrote the book The Blood Covenant, goes into a lot of depth on what a goel actually is according to ancient Near Eastern customs. And speaking of the part where he redeems the blood from a family that was taken away by murder, he writes, "His mission was not of vengeance, but equity. He is not an avenger, but a redeemer, a restorer, a balancer." So all of these things are not about vengeance or just getting something back. It's about restoring something back to its original condition. That's the duty of a goel or redeemer, is to restore something back to its original condition. Which is very interesting, because when you think of Yeshua being the redeemer, what is his ultimate mission? It's to restore mankind back to what God originally intended for us. All right. Another important subject to cover is Judaism's concept of two messiahs. We have Messiah ben Yosef and Messiah ben David. Where this idea comes from is that commentators would see in the text Messiah doing one thing and then the other, and they just could not reconcile this into being one Messiah. So to reconcile those differences, they split it into Messiah ben Yosef and Messiah ben David. Messiah ben Yosef, who's associated with Ephraim, sometimes called Messiah ben Ephraim, is known to be the suffering servant. It's believed that he starts the work of redemption, and that it's Messiah ben David who completes it. In their eschatology, Messiah ben Yosef regathers the 12 tribes and leads them into battle and ends up dying in the battle. And then Messiah ben David is the one who ultimately becomes the conquering king and leads them into the Messianic age. Now, it's important to note that according to their commentary, the Messiah can be from... or the Messiah, ben Yosef, can be from the tribe of Judah, or represented by a descendant of the tribe of Judah. And that comes from the book The Messiah Text by Raphael Patai, and also from a Kabbalistic source called Mergelos Hayom, to Sanhedrin 94a. So when the Messiah comes, he will usher in what is known as Yemot HaMashiach. So they have three, I guess you call them dispensations, but not to be confused with the Christian term of a dispensation. They have the timing known as Olam Hazeh, the world that is. Yemot HaMashiach, which means the days of Messiah, and Olam Haba. In their commentary, they state that in Olam Haba, the world to come, that the Torah will no longer be needed, because since it will be the same as the light of a candle no longer being needed in the blaze of a noonday sun. So according to them, Olam Hazah is going to last 6,000 years, and then Yemot HaMashiach is the 7,000th year. This concept of Olam Hazah, Olam Haba, and Yemot HaMashiach extends back to the times in the first century. And so the disciples understood this terminology. So in Acts chapter 2, they recognize that Messiah had come, and now that they're in Yemot HaMashiach. And that's why they quote Joel 2. Let's go to let's just go to Acts chapter 2 real fast. Let's see, starting in verse Acts chapter 2, verse 16. But this is what was spoken of by the prophet Joel. And it shall be in the last days, says Elohim, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And also on my male servants and on my female servants, I shall pour out my spirit in those days, and they shall prophesy. And I shall show wonders in the heavens above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. And the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and splendid day of Yahweh. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of Yahweh shall be saved. So it's interesting that that verse is quoted, and yet that never occurred fully during that time frame. Now, if we realize that they recognize that they were now in Yemot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, which actually lasts from approximately the year 4000, when Messiah came the first time, to the year 6000, which is when Messiah will return, that whole time period is known as the last days, or Yemot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah. And then when Messiah turns, we'll go into Athid Lavo, the future coming, the Messianic kingdom. All right, and last thing for part one, we're going to go over what a mamzer is. This is the Hebrew word Strong's H4464, and from the Strong's and the Brown Driver Briggs, we get the definitions: to alienate, a mongrel, a bastard, child of incest, illegitimate child, mixed population, born of an Israelite father and a heathen mother, or vice versa. So it's basically any child who is born out of anything that can be construed as an illegitimate marriage. In Yochanan 8, verse 41, let's go there. Go up a little bit for context of verse 39. They, being the Yehudim who believed in Yeshua, they answered him and said, Abraham is our father. And Yeshua said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has spoken to you the truth which I heard from Elohim. Abraham did not do this. You do the works of your father. And they said to him, we were not born of whoring. We have one father, Elohim. So a lot of people have construed that to mean that they tried to imply that he was born of whoring, because Yeshua was born from the Ruach impregnating Mary, and Yosef was not his physical father. And we know that this is not just an isolated incident, because early rabbinical writings, for example, Toldot Yeshu, or Yeshu, accuse Yeshua of being a mamzer. So, this is all going to tie into the book of Ruth that we'll be going over in part two. And I hope that you'll come back and listen to part two, because this is going to be really, really interesting. Thank you. Shalom.